The Lake Delhi community faced an uncertain future when the dam broke. Now that the lake is back, residents are committed to keeping it healthy.
We take the water quality so serious. It's our livelihood here on the lake. Without it, we really have nothing.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll visit Lake Delhi and talk about the challenges facing Iowa's other lakes and lake communities. We'll talk about the curly leaf pondweed and blue-green algae at Lake Okoboji, the CLEAR Project at Clear Lake, and the newly renovated Lake Darling at Lake Darling State Park. We also want to hear about your experiences and your concerns about the water quality in your part of the state. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For the communities that have grown up around Iowa's lakes, the body of water is the heart of the community. It's what draws people there, keeps them there, and of course, drives up property values too. When something happens to the lake, it can be devastating, personally and economically. This hour, we're going to talk about some of the very serious challenges facing Iowa's lakes, as well as efforts to protect and restore some of our lakes. And we'll start with a lake that faced an unlikely challenge. Last week, we took a trip up to Lake Delhi in northeastern Iowa. The lake is open this summer for the first full boating season since 2010, when the dam was breached after the area got 12 inches of rain in just a few hours. Steve Leonard, who is the president of the Lake Delhi District Association, took us around the lake, and we did take a lot of pictures as we toured the lake and the area, so be sure to go to iowapublicradio.org to see what we're talking about. Our first stop was the newly rebuilt dam, which is built right next to the old one. We talked with Pat Colgan, project manager, facilitator, and trustee for the Lake Delhi District Association. In other words, the man who got the new dam built.
Okay, so here's the lake. Here's the beautiful restored lake. And one thing that struck me when the lake came back is I'd forgotten how green it is. It's just beautiful this time of the year. And this actually extends 9 miles upriver. So it's like a highway for the people that are here and people that use the lake. You can just enjoy the entire way up and back, you know, so it's very
peaceful.
That's
a lot of shoreline.
Yeah, it's 18 miles at least.
And is it all lined with private property, with homes?
It's not at all. It's you know, here it is 90 years old, and I'd say maybe a half of it is still natural. So it's just a beautiful place. So during the week, it's this lake, and on the weekend, when the weekenders are here, it's, you know, it's a different lake. It's busy. But, you know, we still have, one thing that happened that's really cool is that the kayakers found it for 7 years when there's no lake, and the kayakers have not left, so they still use it, which is fun because we never had that before, you know. So you have pontoon boats, you have water skiing, you have jet skis, you have canoes, you have a lot of fishing. You know, it's a well-used lake.
So was your plan to come back here and have a nice, quiet retirement?
Yeah, I actually retired at the end of 2010. I lived in New Jersey at the time for the last 15 years, so before I retired. So when this lake went out, I was actually in New Jersey. And we had built our retirement home in 2007 on my parents' property. And then 3 years later, the lake went out. And my wife says, well, I guess you got to get involved. And I said, yeah, I think I probably will. You know.
Very cool. Well, we're going to go inside now, right?
Yep. We're going to go down there. So we'll stop here. And this is brand new. This is the brains of the operation. Remember I said it naturally goes over 300 days of the year. When it doesn't go over naturally, then there's a computer system that takes over. This is called a programmable logic controller, which is a PLC. And this receives a signal from the lake level saying, am I too high or too low? And based on the programming, it'll do something. So this is every 5 minutes, it asks, am I too high or too low? So I wanted the lake at 896.5. And right now it's at 896.4, so it doesn't need to open. But every 5 minutes, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, it asks that question. So this is really why we call it an automatic dam. It's as automatic as it can be.
So even if it rains 10 inches in the middle of the night, you're safe.
And that actually happened September 25th.
Yep.
So it went from a very small flow, on a Thursday night in September last year. It started raining. We had 5 inches here. And they got 8 inches up north. And this thing followed it up. So people that lived below the bridge saw maybe a couple inches of fluctuation, but that was it. Now, people above the bridge in the upper reaches did see flooding, but I have very limited control of that up there. So,
you must have felt pretty good.
It was like flying a jet for the first time because, there's no way to do that other than real. And it had only been in operation 5 weeks, so we'd never even opened the gates under load like that. So we're doing it for real, And that was all night for 22 hours. So
wow. That
was pretty exciting. So so it was like a blessing. It was just one more gift for us because that flood could not have, it's possible it would not have happened for 20 years. But it happened 5 weeks later, and I happened to be here. So, now it's good for a long time, So that was another cool thing.
Nice.
Okay, now it's one long flight.
Okay, now we're in the bunker for real.
Now you're inside the real dam, and the real reason it was here was power companies like Interstate Power. This is how they electrified rural America. So generally, dams were built from around 1900 to about 1937. So this was built in 28. So it was 28 years after they started building them. And you can just imagine they had done it before. So this was not particularly hard to do because this is something that was common. And this was a great benefit for this area because it provided electricity, which helped, electrify rural America. So from 1928 through World War II, the 40s, it was basically for generation. But after World War II, what happened, people came back, got married, had families. Every year back then, you could live a little better than the year before. It was a great time in America. And eventually, people started saying, we need some recreation. So they looked for resorts and then eventually built cabins. And so that's pretty much how it became a recreation area. And by the 1970s, the value of the electricity and the cost of this wasn't that much, and the value of the recreation was far greater. So they worked a deal in the early 1970s between a power company and a newly formed recreation association that transferred ownership. And so it became the LDRA, Lake Delhi Recreation Association.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for showing us around.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are out on Lake Delhi now in a pontoon boat with Steve Leonard. He is president of the Lake Delhi District Association.
So you are looking at, on the left-hand side, not this area, but this area, was just a creek. And it flowed in from, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of acres of watershed to the west of us. Now you're seeing a retaining or a concrete wall and a lot of riprap. And I can't go on in here because there's an underwater dam, but this is a brand new siltation basin that is very large, and it widens up in here, and it's catching a lot of silt where it used to come into this cove and fill this cove up. These are the types of things we have earmarked about 9 locations on the lake that bring in what I would call enough siltation that we need to be mindful of. With that Watershed Management Authority, we're going to be looking at how we can pursue doing even more. These are just some of the examples that we take the water quality so serious. It's our livelihood here on the lake. Without it, we really have nothing.
So you haven't been here really all that long.
No, I haven't. I came to the lake right before the breach of the dam.
How long did you have before the breach?
I had 2 weeks to be able to enjoy our cabin. And I got to be honest, they were the best 2 weeks of my life because we had more friends and family that I have not seen. As soon as they found out that we had a cabin on the lake, everybody wanted to come. And it was great. And it motivated me enough to say, you know what, we really got to get this back. We got to get it back as quickly as possible. So I just raised my hand at that time to the current leaders and say, just let me know how I can help. But the more I got involved, the more I understood what was going on, the more I understood what needed to change and the perceptions that needed to change and the amount of work that needed to take place, I just was all heads in and just whatever it took. And that thousands and thousands of hours, volunteer hours later, here we are.
Were you here the night of the breach?
I was. I was here the night of the breach. I was at upstream helping a friend of mine tie up his docks to a tree. When you get 12 inches of rain in our watershed in less than a 24-hour period of time, that was a life-changing moment for me. Good and bad, bittersweet.
When did you realize the enormity of what had happened?
Once the breach took place, I saw this huge whirlpool effect. I call it a toilet bowl effect because it looked like someone had flushed the toilet and the water was swirling so bad. And that's when the dam breached and the water was coming down so fast that it created this whirlpool effect. So that was kind of the first eye-opening experience. But working with the government, federal government, state government, our local community government, everything's got a governmental bureaucracy to it, and everybody has their steps and processes, and there's this whole political system that really decides what's going to take place. I was awoken to the fact of this is a political beast, if you will, to get Lake Delhi back.
Tell me, in a nutshell, tell me about the economic impact of this lake, because you did. You saw it all go down the drain.
Yeah. Our property values, literally within the very first year, our land values dropped 70%. So if you can imagine having 70% of your land just be worth nothing. But not only is it a big deal to the local residents, it was a huge deal to the school district, who was forced to make some very tough decisions about laying off teachers because our taxable base went down, so our property taxes went down, so the school district had to make some really tough decisions. Then the local businesses, we had many of them shut down or laying off employees. Our community, you know, suffered hugely from losing the lake. When you have a lake community without a lake, it's not a good situation.
Now, you only had 2 weeks on the lake before the breach, but you were really familiar with it. So contrast Lake Delhi now versus Lake Delhi then.
The key differences from a structural perspective is we got a dam that's going to last us 100 plus years. We don't have to worry about a dam going away. So that's a great thing as an investor from the state or the county or us that we feel good and comfortable with every night. We can sleep about that. I'd also say that all the things that we have done to make it more accessible publicly, we all benefit from that. More friends and family can come to the lake and use it like we use it.
Steve, thank you so much for talking with us and taking us for a ride.
You bet. Absolutely. I appreciate you coming out.
Right now I'm visiting with Steve Leonard. He's president of the Lake Delhi District Association. Of course, the lake is back after a dam breach in 2010. The dam has been rebuilt. The lake is full again, and people are enjoying it. We will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Iowa's lakes and lake communities. If you'd like to see pictures from our trip to Lake Delhi, you can find them on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And of course, Iowa doesn't have a lot of lakes, at least in comparison to some other states, but we do love the lakes that we have. And a lot of those lakes are facing serious challenges. In a few minutes, we'll talk about lake restoration efforts at Clear Lake and Lake Darling. But first, Mary Skopik is the executive director of the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory up on Lake Okoboji. She spent many years working in different positions with the Department of Natural Resources in Iowa before leading the laboratory, so she knows a great deal about water quality in Iowa. Hello, Mary.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And up on Lake Okoboji this year, there's been a lot of frustration among people who are there because they love the lake. They want to get in the water. They want to take their boats out on the water. The frustration this year has been largely because of curly leaf pondweed. What's been going on?
So curly leaf pondweed is an invasive species, and the issue with invasive species is they often grow very rapidly, and there aren't things that keep them in check. With native populations of animals and plants, there's usually something that keeps them in balance, and they don't grow out of control. This year, we've seen the curly leaf pondweed really choking out the upper part of East Okoboji, which has created a lot of frustration for people who want to get their boats in and around and enjoy the lake. And that's been a big issue for us this year.
And this weed has been around, what, since the 1950s?
Yeah, so the weed has been there, but has been kept in check a little bit. One of the things that we're seeing is some of the changes in climate, for example. We have less ice cover on the lakes in the last couple of years, and so the light is getting into the lake bottom early in the season, earlier than usual, and it really kind of gives the curly leaf pondweed a jump start on growing. So it's been there in the past, but it's really becoming more problematic in the last couple of years.
Now, this pondweed, of course, it interacts with the other things going on in the lake. What other than just really annoying people who don't want to get that weed caught in their boat engines, making it impossible for people and businesses to take their boats out on the water, what else is it doing to the lake?
Well, one of the things that we've seen, of course, anything like a plant has got an ecology. And so one of the things we've seen this year is record levels of water clarity in East Okoboji, where we don't have if you're trying to look through the water column, you can actually see further into the lake than you have in the past because that curly leaf pondweed is pulling nutrients out. And along with the zebra mussels, which are another invasive species here, are really clearing the water. The problem is because this curly leaf pondweed is a cool water species, we're starting to see the die-off. And so right now the issue is it smells terrible as the weed is dying, and then it's releasing nutrients. So one of our big concerns is that as the phosphorus and nitrogen is released from that vegetation, things like blue-green algae will start to suck up those nutrients and bloom. And we're seeing evidence right now that those blooms are really getting going, and they have their own issues. The blue-green algae has been around for a billion years, but it is has an adaptation where it can produce a toxin. And we're a little bit concerned that we're going to see this really unpleasant blue-green algae bloom starting to happen in July and August here in the Okoboji area.
Okay, so blue-green algae, like you said, that's been around for a long time. But I know a lot of people who interact with Iowa lakes have been really concerned about it in recent years. We have this email from Jim in West Des Moines. He said, "My wife and I have a houseboat at Lake Red Rock. We've boated there for the last 10 years. I just wanted to let you and your listeners know about the issues we've seen over the last few years with blue-green algae. A couple of years ago, around the 1st of August, it was so bad that we could hardly be on our houseboat. The water literally looked like someone had poured melted blue-green colored plastic on the water, and it smelled toxic. When we went out on a ski boat ride, the wake of the boat looked like we were in thick pea soup. It was bad. Please ask what would cause the algae to be so bad." That's a question a lot of Iowans are asking. So why has the blue-green algae gotten so bad in so many locations?
Well, you're right, and it's a great question. There are a number of factors. So blue-green algae are adapted, again, like any plant. They're very opportunistic. So they're pulling up nutrients that are released into the water column. Some of them, we know the one type of blue-green algae, which is Microcystis, likes a little nutrient bump early in the spring. It likes a little nitrate bump. And we have seen over the last couple of years in particular, heavy spring rains, high levels of nitrate in 2013, 14, 15. So we're kind of giving them a little boost, a little shot of nitrogen early in the season, and they really take off. They really love that. The other thing that we've seen is one term has been coined, weather whiplash. We have these tremendous rainstorms, and then we have really calm, almost droughty conditions. And the blue-green algae have an adaptation that allows them to regulate their buoyancy, which basically means they can float to the surface, they can pull the nutrients, but then they can outcompete the other algae and plants for light. And because they can sit at the top of the water, they can bloom and really take over a lake. The other thing is that they really like warm water. So the blue-green algae like that warmer water, where things like a diatom or a green algae like a little bit cooler water. So as our weather regimes and our climate regimes switch to being hotter water, sort of earlier springs, we all know that we had a very mild winter. All these things really kind of create a situation, a perfect storm, as you might say, for these blue-green algae blooms to become problematic. And we did see in the Department of Natural Resources the number of advisories related to those toxins hit a record number last year. And so we are, you know, concerned that this is a pattern that is going to become more and more persistent.
Well, and let's talk about why the advisories. What is so toxic about this blue-green algae? What's the danger to people and animals?
Yeah, so there are four toxins that can be produced by the blue-green algae. Many of them attack the liver and can cause nausea and liver failure. Some of them are neurotoxins. One particular toxin that's produced by blue-green algae is saxitoxin. That's a weapons-grade kind of toxin that the military might use. And so these things are very serious. Now, luckily, we haven't seen a lot of human issues in Iowa, but we do know that we have dog deaths. Dogs are very susceptible, and if they swim in that water or lick the cells off their fur or drink the water, they may become sick and die even within hours of ingesting that toxin. Livestock are known to be susceptible, sheep and cattle. So these are very serious chemicals that we want to make sure we can prevent them from setting up in the lakes. There's not a lot of good knowledge about why in particular these blue-green algae produce these toxins and when they might produce them, because they don't always produce the toxin. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And it's impossible to tell just by looking at the water if it is a toxic bloom. It's certainly unpleasant, as Jim said, that scummy water. You don't want to swim in it and you don't want your dog in it, but really requires testing to see if it is producing a toxin. But overall, it's a very unpleasant situation for Iowa lakes and one that we need to be thinking about reducing the number of nutrients that we have washing into those lakes. And then, you know, just trying to put some other factors like the curly leaf pondweed or the aquatic vegetation is a nuisance for boaters, but it does serve a purpose, not so much the invasive, but other rooted vegetation serves a purpose to suck up those nutrients and keep it away from the algae. So we do want to see more rooted vegetation in our lakes to help sequester and pull those nutrients out of the water.
So we can't do anything to control the weather at this point. So the warmth is probably going to continue in the summer months. But if we work on restoring wetlands and if we work on controlling that nutrient runoff, do you feel like Iowans can make an impact on this blue-green algae?
I do think we do have the opportunity to make an impact. And as you said, wetlands are very helpful. Trying to do everything we can on the landscape to keep those nutrients on the farm field and not running off into our lakes. Shoreline protection, so putting in, again, that rooted vegetation along the shoreline helps to protect the lake. So there are things that we can do. And our lake restoration program that the Department of Natural Resources has going on has been very effective at restoring some of the lakes in Iowa. So I think we have a pretty good blueprint of what we can do to help protect them and to restore them and keep them good for recreation and drinking water and just overall water quality.
Dave is on the line in Norwalk with a question. Hi, Dave. Dave, can you hear me? Well, I'll ask Dave's question for him. I'm not sure why we got feedback there, but he says he's worried about the water quality in his area and wants to know how to find out more. Can he test it? Who should he call to know what's in the water?
Well, there are a couple things that they can do in terms of knowing what's in the water. If you want to look at the blue-green algae toxin, for example, that's a laboratory test that would require somebody to run a sample in the lab. The State Hygienic Laboratory at the University of Iowa has that capability, as well as Iowa DNR and those of us at Iowa Lakeside Laboratory. And if someone collects a sample and sends it to one of those entities, they might be able to get that sample run and tested. The one thing I'm cautious to tell people is, you know, the sample may come back negative, but then a week later, the toxin might be produced. So it's a little bit of trying to make sure that you're looking at it through time, which is why a DNR or other programs are looking at that toxin week in, week out, because the conditions change. But certainly if people want to have their sample, if they've got a lake or a pond, they want it tested, they can find that on some of the state websites. So again, check out DNR or the State Hygienic Laboratory or those of us at Lakeside Lab. In terms of other water quality things like nutrients, there are simple field tests that can be done, a field kit that allows you to basically do a dipstick and put it in the water, and you can get a nitrogen level or a phosphorus level. And the iWater Volunteer Monitoring Program has been looking at nutrients that way for almost 20 years. And so they're very citizen-friendly. They're easy to interpret and to read. So if people are interested in that, my contact information is on the Lakeside Lab webpage, and I'm happy to help people find those resources if they would like.
I'm talking with Mary Skopik. She is the executive director of the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory up on Lake Okoboji. And we're talking about water quality in Iowa, some of the challenges facing our lakes, our lake communities as well. I want to bring Jim Shawley into the conversation. He is Watershed Project Coordinator for Clear Lake. He oversees and runs the Clear Project, which has been going on for a number of years to try to improve the water quality at Clear Lake. They've made a lot of progress. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And of course, Clear Lake was named for its water clarity a long time ago. But back in the 1980s, it wasn't so clear. Tell me about some of the problems that Clear Lake started to have then.
Back in the 70s and 80s, there was so much nutrients reaching the lake that, you know, like Mary touched on, we were getting just tremendous algae blooms to the point where folks were afraid to go in the lake. They didn't want to swim in it. They didn't want to boat in it. The lake used to be the water supply for the city of Clear Lake, and the residents were tired of getting the ill effects of that bad algae bloom coming through their water supply, that the city had to drill three wells, groundwater wells, to provide a safe water supply for the city, because the lake couldn't serve that function anymore. And the community kind of stepped up and said, you know what, we don't want to continue down this path, and really created this local coalition that ultimately became the Clear Project and the effort to reverse those trends and try to take their lake back and get that good water clarity that, you know, the lake was so aptly named for.
Well, and in addition, of course, to the economic impact of people not wanting to be on the lake and the property values going down on the lake, you also saw during that time the ecosystem of the lake impacted. I mean, the kinds of fish that could live in the lake, of course, that impacted fishermen, but the ecosystem also was just really suffering, right?
Yes, very much so. A system dominated by that algae, where we get that pea soup green water, is the fish biomass out there is mostly tied up in our rough fish. The carp, the buffalo, the bullhead, those types of species that are traditionally thought to be in kind of dirty water species. We didn't have good stands of that rooted vegetation that provides a home for a lot of our more popular game fish.
And I want to spell this out, because both you and Mary have talked about nutrients entering the water. When we talk about nutrients entering the water, break it down for us. What are we talking about?
Clear Lake and many of the lakes around Iowa are impaired for phosphorus, is one of our big nutrients, which is often, it travels off of our landscape, off of our lawns, our streets, our homes, our cornfields. Most times it is bound to sediment. So when we get heavy erosion happening because of our big rainstorms, it's carrying that phosphorus down through to our streams and to our lakes. And that is one of the primary fuels to what that algae is then sucking up.
And where's the phosphorus coming from?
All around us. It is a commercial fertilizer on our crop fields. It is in all of our lawn chemicals to get our lawns bright and green. And it's It travels on sediment. Anytime there's erosion, anytime we get a heavy rainstorm, it is carrying that. It travels very easily to our lakes. And everything that we do on our landscape impacts the amount that is being released. Every time we disturb soil through tillage on our farm fields, through construction sites in town, we are opening ourselves up to easily allowing that nutrient to escape our land and head straight to our lakes.
Now, Mary, in recent years, in recent decades, really, there has been an effort to control phosphorus, to decrease the amount of phosphorus getting into our environment. It used to be in every kind of dishwashing detergent, and now it's not. I mean, have we seen an impact from that in Iowa's lakes and streams, less phosphorus?
We have, and that's the good news, is we have seen levels come down from sort of record numbers. As Jim said, you know, if you think about when we first opened up the prairie, we had incredible erosion from practices that didn't really do much in terms of controlling sediment runoff. And so we've seen improvements there. The thing to recognize with phosphorus is lakes are extremely sensitive to it. Very small levels can cause that lake to become very green. One of sort of the strange things that happens is, in some ways, when we used to have very muddy lakes, the algae couldn't even really grow because the light penetration into the water wasn't very good. As we've kind of held some of that sediment back, the residual phosphorus now is causing those algae blooms. So it's one of those situations where we move from green water or brown water to green water, we still need to take it to clear water. So a little bit more cleaning needs to happen.
All right, and we'll talk about some of the efforts that have taken place at Clear Lake that have resulted in a lot more water clarity there. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. With me, Mary Skopic, Executive Director of the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory, and Jim Shawley, Watershed Project Coordinator for Clear Lake. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Iowa's lakes, some of the challenges facing Iowa lakes, some of the efforts that have brought a couple of lakes back from the brink. We're talking about Clear Lake right now. We're going to talk about Lake Darling in a few minutes. With me, Mary Skopic. She is the Executive Director of the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory on Lake Okoboji. Jim Shawley is here. He's Watershed Project Coordinator for Clear Lake. He also oversees and runs the Clear Project, which has really made an impact on water quality in that lake. You're also welcome to join our conversation. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can give us a call, 866-780-9100. Before the break, we were talking about phosphorus, nitrates, nitrogen, also something that is a major concern in our lakes, in our different bodies of water. Jim, Clear Lake, tell me about that concern.
We actually are not impaired for nitrates here. They are coming into the water, so they are moving downstream, but our major impairment is that phosphorus, and the vast majority of the work we're doing is to try to reverse that trend and to try and tie up those nutrients before they hit the lake.
And Mary, give us a big picture on nitrogen and nitrates in Iowa.
Sure. So the big picture on nitrate is we have seen some increases over the last 5 years where it looked like things were going down and we were sort of on a downward trajectory. And since about 2013, coming out of the drought, things have really kind of taken that ski jump back up. And so part of that's, you know, the rain that we've had after drought, and some of that is just the, you know, overall warming of the climate where we have these really mild winters, and stuff is moving in those farm fields much sooner than we normally would get. So, you know, the nitrate story is one where we still need to continue to really try and limit that movement off the landscape. I would say for lakes, some of the emerging research is saying that phosphorus alone will not get us to clear water state, that we really need to have nitrogen reductions as well. And that's sort of new research. And what we're finding is that, again, the algae are very opportunistic. If they have that nitrogen, they'll use it. instead of having to work for it and having to pull it out of the atmosphere. So it's really kind of a double-edged sword that we really need to take both of them down to get the best water quality in our lakes as possible.
Well, and we've had a number of callers who want to ask a question about, you know, how much of this phosphorus, how much of the nitrate is coming from commercial agricultural activity. And we'll start just with Clear Lake. First, Jim, if you have to break it down between urban and rural runoff that's impacting the lake, what's your take?
Clear Lake, we are about 50-50. Our watershed is about 50% comprised of agricultural lands. The other half is about 30% of our watershed is in urban areas and developed, and the other 20% or so is in permanent vegetation. So we're really seeing pollution coming from both the ag and the urban sectors. And the project is working hard to try to address opportunistic areas in both of those areas.
So give me a couple examples of things that you feel you can make an impact on.
On our ag lands, a big thing in the last 10 years, a lot of our very sensitive, highly erodible ground has been converted from crop field to a buffer strip or filter strip with permanent vegetation. That has done a lot to try and lock up those soils and those nutrients. Around town, we work to try and put in our urban practices, bioretention cells, rain gardens, pervious pavers, on a lot of our biggest developed areas where there's a lot of concrete draining towards the lake, ways we can intercept that water. And I work with a lot of homeowners around the lake and around town who are very enthusiastic on what they can do to capture the stormwater coming from their individual lots around their homes, because that does carry a tremendous amount of pollution towards the lake, and it's great to see so many citizens that want to step up and try to reverse that trend.
And Mary, again, bigger picture in Iowa, what is the main area of concern?
Well, if we look at the state overall, one of the challenges is we have about 28, depending on the year, maybe 28 million acres of cropland. And that certainly is very dominant on the landscape. And we see that in our, there was a nutrient budget done for nitrogen and phosphorus a few years back, where, you know, 90% of the nitrogen was coming from agricultural lands, 80-ish percent of phosphorus was coming from agricultural lands. But the one thing I think Jim has really touched on, especially for lakes, it's important to think about the watershed or the land draining to the lake. Clear Lake has a relatively small watershed, and Okoboji's are similar. There's not as much land around that lake, and so the sources tend to be more local, as opposed to if you're looking at a river, and the Des Moines River is a huge watershed. And so we have to think about how that watershed is different from a small lake versus a big lake versus a big river. But overall, we know that agriculture is a big player, and we really need agriculture and urban areas to come together and fix our water issues.
And Jim, before we let you go, what has made the greatest impact in Clear Lake? Because you have really turned things around. The locals feel so much better about the lake. You've got a lot of clarity back to the water, right?
We have. In the last 10 years or so, we've taken our water clarity. It was out there just a week ago measuring that in our Secchi depth, which measures how far down into the lake light penetrates, and you can see was nearly 4.5 feet. And for this time of year was just tremendous. We were so excited for that, and the locals have commented that's a sharp contrast to just the several inches we saw maybe 30 years ago this time of year. And one of the biggest things that has happened recently that to attribute to that is the wetland and marsh renovations that have gone on throughout the watershed. There's been some smaller wetlands restored up within our farm grounds, and then a big project that happened about 8 to 10 years ago now was the Ventura Marsh renovation, which sits on the far west side of the lake, and about half of our watershed flows into the lake through that marsh. And through a big partnership with the Army Corps of Engineers, EPA, and many local entities, we were able to rebuild or put in a new fish barrier between the lake and that marsh that allowed allow us for the water level in the marsh to be drawn down so that we can rehabilitate the vegetation that's out there and control fish populations within that. And when that project wrapped up, that first renovation happened, in the years immediately following that, we saw a very sharp increase in our water quality on the lake that could be attributed to many of the factors surrounding having that functioning wetland back out there.
So what is the biggest challenge that you feel you're facing in the future on Clear Lake?
Right now we have a lot of agricultural ground still that has remained untreated. There's heavy tillage that, and it is a culture shift among the agricultural industry of what we would call conventional farming. That's how my grandpa did it. That's how my dad did it. Towards a management scheme that is more centered around soil health, ecosystem management, knowing that we want to sustainably grow a crop on these fields for years to come. And there are ways that we can do that while also making vast improvements for water quality for the nutrients that are leaving those fields. That culture shift, the adoption of some of those practices is going to be a very slow road to travel, but it is a very important one that we're going to try to go down through a series of workshops and education and getting landowners in contact with folks that are doing this and finding out what works and what doesn't and how it can be applied to their farms.
Well, Jim Shawley, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity. I appreciate the opportunity.
Jim Shawley is Watershed Project Coordinator for Clear Lake. He also oversees and runs the CLEAR Project. And with me, Mary Skopik, Executive Director of the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory on Lake Okoboji. I also want to bring Faye Vitito into the conversation. She's a board member and past president of the Friends of the Lake Darling Group. Lake Darling at Lake Darling State Park in southeastern Iowa is a lake that has been renovated and restored. Hello, Faye.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And this is a lake that had been referred to by some as a mud hole.
And yes.
Had been
yes.
Not very many people were being drawn to Lake Darling. Tell me some of the main challenges that were facing the lake.
The main challenges was the gate was set by actually our Iowa hero, conservation hero, and cartoonist J.N. Ding Darling. And he was actually at Lake Darling in September of 1950 and set that gate. And shortly after his demise, and by the mud hole article we refer to is actually Des Moines Register picture magazine from the mid-60s. Not much was being done to that. And by the year 2000, again, the Des Moines Register saw what was going on, and Lake Darling was listed as a lake with superbugs, which technically was a misnomer. But by then, we had lost a lot of our water recreation tourism. The lake by Iowa State University card was tagged as a $1 million community asset to the communities surrounding the lake as an economic asset. And the number of folks coming through the gate at Lake Darling was dropping dramatically. So things had, within 2.5 generations, gone from a prized lake that farmers actually got together and gave up 1,500 acres and went to Des Moines and said, we want a recreational park here with water recreation. So within 2.5 generations, things can change.
Yeah, so it was a man-made lake, is a man-made lake, but it was dealing with a lot of these issues that we're talking about with nutrient runoff, of course. But
that is correct.
A lot of the runoff, the erosion, it was just filling in, right?
That is correct. And Lake Darling is filled by 12,500 acres of watershed, which is entirely agriculture, unlike the Clear Lake situation. And it was interesting, if you know what was happening in agriculture, and agricultural technologies shift through the years. And we had gone from fallowing ground and raising corn and then putting it back to a pasture land of alfalfa or clover to row crop after row crop, rotating soybeans and corn. Soil conservation was a very important part of the watershed, but it wasn't sufficient in the year 2000 to stop the trend of literally truckloads of silt of Iowa topsoil heading into the lake.
Yeah, and we're nearly out of time, Faye, but tell me, I mean, the lake was drained. It was drained more than once, in fact. It was dredged. What's the lake like today?
The lake today has the same acequia as the Clarity, and we can see down the lake 4 foot. It took 16 years of both work in the watershed. We have over 75, close to 80% of the farmers not doing soil and water conservation in a good way, but in an exemplary way with silt retention basins. 75 new ones were put in, 25 new silt retention basins or ponds were put in the 1,500-acre park. Our lake was, with marine fuel tax, the lake restoration program dredged out a lot of the silt and topsoil that was left in the lake in 1950, plus what had been added. The lake had shrunk to 267 acres, is back to over 304. The Friends of Lake Darling, with private partnerships and publics, have added amenities to the lake to where it's now a year-round park and an $8.5 million community asset. There's a lot of pride in the farmers. It's a unique lake in that it's on a public ground. It is truly collects the agricultural runoff of those 12,500 acres and is a good self-assessment of what we're doing on the land and the farming. We're very proud of our farmers and our watershed.
Well, Faye, thank you so much for
You're very welcome.
Faye Vitito is a board member and past president of the Friends of Lake Darling Group. And Mary, we are nearly out of time, but something that has come up when Faye was talking, it came up when Jim was talking, and you were talking about it earlier, is the restoration of wetlands around lakes, or even in some cases, if it's a man-made lake, the installation of wetlands around lakes. And we know a lot more than we used to about the incredible power of wetlands to improve lake health, right?
Absolutely. And if you look at Iowa, we lost, again, about 90% of our wetlands as we settled the state of Iowa. But if we bring those wetlands back, they slow the water to the lake. They let the sediment drop out. The wetland vegetation sucks up those nutrients, uses those nutrients. And so they are like the kidneys of the watershed. They help to purify the water before it gets to the lake. And they are critically important to the overall health of a lake ecosystem.
So looking at the future, what are your main concerns, your main challenges that you'd like to see all Iowans take on for the health of not just lakes, but our water in our state?
Well, I think it comes back to everybody has a part to play to maintain a healthy ecosystem. So if we can, and I often think of the land as the skin of the watershed, so we need to make sure that we cover that. And whether it's cover crops or putting in wetlands, every acre of Iowa land needs to be, something has to happen to that land to protect it from erosion and from water running off, carrying nutrients. So it's not, we can't just use Band-Aids to fix the problem in Iowa. We need sort of whole-scale landscape management. And then I think it's about making sure that we are not just thinking that the job is done and walking away. Many of these lakes have gone through renovation before, so we need to make sure that we're maintaining those practices long term, that we continue to keep the vegetation on the landscape and in the lake as well. So it's sort of being vigilant that we don't just sort of think that we've got it fixed and then move on to the next issue. We have to have consistent management.
And we've talked a lot about agricultural practices, but urban lawn practices also are extremely important in this, right?
They are, and I think it's about making sure that everyone does their part. So whether it's doing phosphorus-free fertilizer or maybe, you know, using prairie plants on your lawn, not adding chemicals that you don't necessarily need to add to your lawn is important. And again, it's about everyone values these waters, the lakes. We all need to work to protect them.
Well, Mary Skopic, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Mary Skopic is the executive director of the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory on Lake Okoboji. This hour, we've been talking about Iowa's lakes and the many challenges facing our water in Iowa. If you'd like to see pictures from our visit to Lake Delhi, please go to our website, iowapublicradio.org. This is a conversation that we will continue on Talk of Iowa in the future, something a lot of Iowans care deeply about. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.